Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Hey, everybody, it's Friday. We made it through another one, almost. Today is apparently potentially a big news day. It wasn't Chris Hayes. It was one of them on cable news who was saying that he predicts that because Justice Department guidelines say blah, blah, blah with investigations, nothing after Labor Day before an election, that leaves today as the last news day for big stuff to drop from the Justice Department.
Manafort pardon.
maybe.
I don't know if he can. I don't think he can do it, one, nor do I think he can do it yet, even if he could.
Oh, well, and he says that he won't. This is Francesca Fiorentino, by the way. Good to have you here. I'm John Adirola. This is the Damage Report. Feeling very damaged today. We've got so much to get to, so much work ahead of us, but some of it is going to be fun. Let's start off with something, I don't know, fun, bad for the country, but feels good for me.
Ooh, okay.
And that's really what's important. So let's bring up this first graphic. You're going to see Trump approval and disapproval, the newest numbers. And he has reached 60% disapproval, which is a big number, obviously. I believe in this particular poll, it's the highest it's ever been. But much more interestingly, the strongly disapprove is 53%. I don't know that I've ever seen as high of a share of disapprove be so strongly.
What is an adult in 2018? That's my only question. This says all adults.
Yeah.
And I'm just not sure if the definition is still the same. Have we lowered the age of adulthood?
We've lowered the bar.
I think we should raise it. We've definitely lowered the bar.
I think it should not just be a strictly age thing. I think that you should have to demonstrate that you act as an adult should. But anyway, you saw there 36% still approve of him, which is obviously close to what it's been for a long time. 24% strongly approve. So that might be a little bit lower. And that makes me feel a little bit positive. Considering he's not doing as badly as I would have predicted that he would when he was elected, but few presidents have been able to do this poorly with this kind of acceptable at first glance economic, situation that they've inherited. Like, the unemployment rate continues to go down. Obviously, in terms of wages and everything, it's a complete nightmare. You know that because you pay attention. But things look okay at the macro level, and yet he's still got a 60% disapproval rating.
So to screw up such a good economy that he's inherited, it's like you have to be a corrupt Manchurian candidate. Wow, that's
yes,
crazy.
And perhaps a little bit of a white supremacist.
Just a bit. I think also the silent majority who supposedly didn't come out and say they wanted to vote for him initially in all the polling that was wrong before the 2016 election are not going to then turn around and be like, well, now I want to answer all the polls about me being wrong about this president. I didn't want to say that I was going to vote for him. And I sure as hell don't want to say that I was mistaken in voting for him. So I think his disapproval rating might even be greater. I think the base is just it's just backwash, honestly. And I think we have to remember, people are good. We can turn this around.
Yeah. Well, we're certainly going to try. But this show is about facing, without too much fear, the actual threats facing us. And one is the threat to our sanity. And the way that politicians, especially Trump, are communicating about policies it's no longer within radio contact of reality. They speak as the insane do, and we have a great example of that with Donald Trump at his Evansville rally in Indiana last night. He was talking about socialism, because every single Democratic candidate is a socialist. We know that. That's been true for a long time. Listen to the way he describes their plans.
And they want to raid Medicare to pay for socialism.
I have to assume that the booing you heard was people saying, that doesn't make any logical sense.
I mean, you could just say socialism. It's just so bizarre. Obviously, okay.
Can I get a napkin to wipe?
Saying,
brain is coming out of my ears. I'd like to wipe away some of the brain.
Yeah, here, just tuck that back in. No, seriously though, raiding Medicare to pay for socialism is like saying they want to raid your fridge to make dinner.
Yeah.
Can you believe that? Look at it.
What I thought of was
there's
food related too.
Sides and actually. Turkey looks pretty good, but they're raiding the fridge. Like what?
How dare they?
How dare they?
And at dinner time.
I know.
Yes, it makes absolutely no sense. And yet, as is, like we had a few weeks ago, we had when you go to the supermarket, you know, you gotta use photo ID, and everyone's in the crowd's just like, I like this president. That's attached to reality. That makes sense for humans. And here, raid Medicare to pay for socialism. Raid Medicare. Has he spoken with Paul Ryan, who's talked about more cuts to Medicare? They've already cut Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, all that stuff. They want to do much more of that. The Democrats, literally the ones that we're interested in, are running on Medicare for all.
Right.
Not raided Medicare, see you later. Mm-hmm. More of it. And as Dan, our from the internet, pointed out earlier today, we've come full circle from keep your government hands off my Medicare. Like, I guess this is no stupider than that, but previously I had a higher level of expectations for politicians than for random people.
And to be honest with you, this is why I think that only a progressive candidate can actually be a challenge to Trump in 2020 and in 2018. Because why? You have to get someone who is unafraid to say, you are a populist Trojan horse. Mm-hmm. You've taken what people clearly in this country love, which is Medicare, all the polling shows it, and instead of actually delivering on expanding Medicare, or at least not cutting it, which you promised to do in your campaign, you actually put all the Republicans in power who have been gutting it, you've made reforms to Medicare, you've given Paul Ryan a blank check, and you're doing the exact opposite. And I think that only a progressive can be able to, like, point that out and can actually, you know, have an affront to that and say, yeah, no, I embrace democratic socialism, or call it socialism if you want to. Whereas I think, again, sorry to say, but like the Bidens of the world are not going to be able to counter that so clearly BS of an argument with sort of more of the same, like, well, it's not socialism. You're like, maybe it is.
Yeah.
Maybe it is.
Well, and they will certainly have the fear that. So the question I wanted to ask you was, can we win the messaging war around socialism or democratic socialism, which you've gotten into? And I guess to win that, we have to be willing to engage in it.
Right.
And there are many politicians who are quite popular who will not engage in that war, who will cede so much territory as they have throughout their careers on some fundamental concepts that we need people to understand to push particular policies. Mm-hmm. And it's not like we shouldn't talk about it because at least the other side isn't talking about it. You can see at their rallies, they're losing their minds over these issues that they don't understand at all. And we need to fight back against that.
Right.
There is so little information about what socialism is. People's ideas of it are based on some other country's experience 50 years ago.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today, and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
And democratic socialism is so new that in terms of people's exposure to it, that most people have no idea what that actually is. That is why we need people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who've been lucky enough to break through into being on Hardball and The Daily Show, and Stephen Colbert, to at least give a defense of it, an introduction to it. We so desperately need that, especially going into extremely consequential elections.
I just want to know what happened to, like, monster truck rallies And this is not to be disparaging to Trump supporters, but like a little bit disparaging. But like, you could just replace Trump with monster trucks. People want to yell. People want to yell. They want to be angry. Like, what happened to wrestling? It exists still. Like, go to a wrestling match. It's fun. Yeah. You can yell. You can hate someone. Like, this is not entertainment. This is real life. This is your Medicare.
But but for them, it's both, really. So we've been talking recently about how people grow attached to certain messengers. So he has a message, Donald Trump, and he is effectively politically something of a contrarian in that he, if something makes rational, logical sense, he's going to say the opposite of it.
I like how you said messengers rather than messengers.
Yeah.
Because I feel like it makes more
sense. Well, he is delivering more of a personal message, I think.
Right.
Rather than delivering it for someone else, which I consider to be a messenger. But in any event, we need to fight back against this. Identity politics means whatever the person's saying it wants it to mean. But if you can look at that interaction and not see that as playing to some sort of white conservative identity, I don't know what you saw there. Clearly, Donald Trump, regardless of what he's talking about, if it's immigration, if it's the wall, if it's Hillary Clinton, whatever, there is a particular resentful, like entitled white identity that he is the avatar for.
Yep. Which, as I keep saying on your show, doesn't have to go away once you vote Trump out. You can still hang on to your fragile white identity. You can still.
I will.
Yes, you will. And listen, graft that onto someone else. We'll talk about it. We'll deal with it. But like, don't make him, he's not like your avatar.
Mm-hmm. I hope not. We're going to take our first break though. When we come back, new polls on what America thinks about the NFL protests. And a GOP official lets us know what she thinks about it. Can you guess what it is? We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to the Dan Report, everybody. John Iadarola, Francesca is in studio once again, and we're turning now to the NFL protests. I don't think it should necessarily matter what regular people think of it, but I am curious, certainly, because of the messaging going on around these protests. So let's turn to a new poll. This is NBC News, Wall Street Journal poll. Showing that is kneeling during the anthem to protest racial equality, is it appropriate or not appropriate? Among all voters, 43% think it's appropriate. The majority say not appropriate. And the difference in terms of, that's all voters. For Republicans, 10% think it's appropriate. Oh, are they not merciful? 88% say it's not appropriate, which might be the highest level of sort of uniformity amongst a group of party voters on any issue.
Mm-hmm.
88%, which to me says, and by the way, 23% of Democrats don't think it's appropriate, so that's wonderful. And independents are actually more against it than all voters, so that should scare you as well. But if 88% of Republicans think that it's not appropriate, it's not like they have thought critically about this issue and just landed on, you know what, I'd prefer if they didn't do it. It obviously is speaking to something more core, perhaps unspoken, perhaps not even consciously recognized. What do you think it might be?
I want to be respectful.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
But I can't be because it's just knee-jerk idiocy. Like, sorry, but it's kneeling is about knee-jerk reactions. That's all it is. We know that's what it is. We know that's what the president has used it for. We know that he's admitted that that's what he uses it for, that he uses the NFL issue to cover his behind when anything else is going on, like his campaign chairman being indicted and all the guilty verdict or pleas. And Rudy Giuliani has admitted that. And I think it's one of these struggles that this country's always going to have to deal with, which is seemingly looking anti-patriotic. Of course, this protest has nothing to do with whether one is patriotic or not. In fact, of course, the people who do kneel, the players and the people who support them say that it is absolutely an emblem of patriotism to say that you are protesting the killing of unarmed Americans, right? Mm-hmm. And so for them, this is patriotism. I think, however, as someone who's never stood for the national anthem, I like baseball. I don't stand for the anthem. Why? 'Cause I don't like it. Like, I came of a baseball age when the Iraq War was going on. And for me, it was patriotic to not stand up and put my hand over my heart when we were wasting trillions of dollars in Iraq and Afghanistan and killing people and torturing people. No, I'm not going to see, you know, images coming out of Abu Ghraib and then the next day go to a baseball game and stand up and support the country just cause.
Yeah.
No, that's not how it works. So anyway, I have a lot of feelings, but I think this is one of those Thanksgiving issues. It's like, hey, let's ruin the family and talk about kneeling, you know, and like, we know it is, again, a straw man.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And in terms of it being a straw man, that Thanksgiving argument is going to become divisive before the position is even fully stated, because people who are against it will say, I'm against them kneeling to protest the anthem, which we know they are not doing. If you cared enough about this issue to talk to one person who doesn't agree with you on it before you solidify your views into, you know, concrete. They are not protesting the anthem. They are protesting the killing of unarmed Americans at huge numbers going back literally to the beginning of our country. And they've been very clear about that. I said on Twitter a few weeks ago, I don't think that any major protest movement in my life has ever been more clear about what it is that they're protesting and had more just never-ending attempts by the other side to fundamentally lie about what the point of that protest actually is.
Nor more powerful. I mean, by successful athletes, you know, Black Americans who are standing in solidarity with other Black Americans who, I mean, even if they knew who they were, if they were successful athletes or not, but like who are often treated the same way by police or who are given a pass simply because they're famous and have money. You don't get, you know, more powerful and moving and important than this.
Extremely frustrating. And I just want to say again, I like highlighting these little cases, not because anecdotal evidence by itself is enough to convince you of anything. You need to see trends, you look at the data, you know, all of that stuff. But it just keeps coming up. So the Republican committee of Beaver County Secretary Carla Maloney had been posting on Facebook about these protests. She had a lot of wonderful things to say. I'm not going to read all of them, but I will read one quote. Steelers are now just as bad as the rest of the overpaid baboons. You respect your flag, country, and our national anthem. How many men and women have lost limbs or died to protect this country, and you baboons want respect? Okay.
Beaver County, really leaning into that.
Just call them
name.
Yeah. So this person, again, I get you don't buy that Ron DeSantis was being racist when he was like monkeying with the state or whatever. She's not calling them baboons randomly or because she had some sort of bad childhood experience with baboons and now she associates them with bad things. I do that with polar bears. There's no racial connotation of polar bears that I know of, at least in America.
That's why you hate white people.
That's something, yeah. Scared of their white fur. No, but she did. She's speaking this way and views this protest because she fundamentally hates the people that are doing it, and she hates their race, and she doesn't. Like, it doesn't matter that what they're doing is upholding all of like the rights and sort of political obligations that we have as a country to protest for things that we think are wrong or for a change in policies. Those people that she cites that lost limbs or died. I would argue that if they're doing that, it is to allow people like the Steelers and other players to do these sorts of peaceful protests.
Absolutely.
And not, you know, I'm gonna go die on some foreign beach so that some racist woman, you know, doesn't ever have to be inconvenienced by someone's political views. That's not American. I mean, she can say it, certainly, but she does not need to be sort of protected or coddled or provided with some sort of space against an incredibly important protest movement like this.
Yeah, and we're in a wonderfully horrible time in terms of like thinly veiled white supremacy, where it's like you can say like, you know, monkey up a race, but like, ooh, baboon, too far. Even though the NFL protests and the way they've been not politicized, they've been racialized by this president. It's absolutely making it not about the issue it is. It's making it about ungrateful Black people and the like gifts they've been given from their white, you know, managers and club owners. Like, that's what this issue is about. And she's just laying it on the table, which is, I mean, we'll see what the reaction is, right? Yeah. Are her fellow Republicans going to say anything? Are they going to make her resign when this is clearly a racial slur?
She did not say it on Sacha Baron Cohen, so I think not. No. But okay, I do want to turn to another issue. Kind of crazy, but a security guard was sentenced Wednesday, actually, to 4 years in jail for manslaughter claims after he stomped a man to death 2 years ago. This is Sheldon Bentley, who was employed as a security guard at the Lucky 97 grocery store in central Edmonton on July of 2016 when he and his partner encountered a man sleeping in an alcove off the alley behind the store. He stomped at Donald Doucette, who died within minutes from massive internal bleeding. Now, without any additional context, this is a horrific thing. But there is some additional context that ties into something that we were recently talking with Lori Penny about a couple of weeks ago. He told Crown Prosecutor Kristen Logan that he seems to put himself into the category of an involuntary celibate person. He spoke of his frustrations that he could not attract a woman despite efforts in person and online. And during the time of the offense, he spoke to how he had built up stress from not having any sexual relations. So we've talked about violent incels in Canada, America. Apparently, they're all over the place now. For him to willingly be giving this information, are we just focusing on the most salacious part of this, or should we actually be worried about this connection?
I think we should absolutely be worried. I mean, I think you threw up a headline there that said Reddit banned an incel group for inciting violence against women, and I think that was the right idea. Mm-hmm. I think that absolutely people are turning and using this excuse of I can't get a date for their horrible isolation and then their violence towards women. And you threw up another headline here about Elliot Rogers in Santa Barbara, who killed, I believe, 5 people or something around that. And a couple of them were women, or the majority were women, and it was all about the fact that he couldn't get a date. And I absolutely think it's something to worry about. Also, homie, like, look in the mirror, dude. Like, why can't you get a date? H&M has, like, disgustingly exploitative prices, all right? Go there. Outfit yourself. Go outside. Talk to people. It is not other people's problems that you can't get laid. Mm-hmm. And also, sex robots are a thing. Yeah. I don't mean to be glib about
this.
They
need to come soon.
I want the dawning of the sex robots.
Okay, well, we agree on that. Yes, and although they often focus on the fact that it's a purely looks thing that stops them from having the intimacy that would apparently stop them from going on homicidal killing sprees, it's not. People, like, your partner cares about, you know, who you are as a person, your hobbies and things. And if your hobby is going online and talking about how you want to rape and murder people.
Hot.
I think that that's the sort of hobby that comes through in a person's eyes and stuff. So totally. Maybe rethink a little bit of that. Maybe get into like painting with watercolors. But anyway, obviously with this massive problem, we talked about Lori Penny. Look up that interview. It's on YouTube now. Men have some issues. They need to be fixed. And I don't see anything positive coming in that area. But we are going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to move on to climate change. California is on the cusp of making an absolutely massive change to their laws when it comes to fighting climate change. And we will talk about that after this. Welcome back to the Damage Report, everybody. We turn now to what I would say, humbly, is the most important issue facing our planet, except we don't act like it ever. Mm-hmm. And even on my show, where, like, climate change is my topic that I literally went to the North Pole for, it's the fourth story we're going to be talking about. But it is climate change. And the reason that we're talking about it is because the California Assembly recently passed a law that would require California to reach 100% clean energy production by 2045. That then moved on to the Senate for a procedural vote. I think that has already actually passed, which means it will now go to the governor to be signed. And if it is signed, California will become just the second state in the country, and obviously by far the largest, since Hawaii is the only one currently, to have this sort of 100% clean energy goal. So that's fairly monumental. Mm-hmm. Obviously it required quite a bit of work to work its way through. Then the actual hard work of reaching those goals will start. Do you find this to be a positive thing, or is this just a, hey, you can say it, but can you actually do it thing?
No, I'm not that cynical. Of course it's big. Like, this is huge. We just have to actually enact it, right? I think it depends on the next governor, Newsom, most likely. I know Jerry Brown has been incredibly pro-fracking, and there's been an incredible, climate justice movement in California led by young people. And there's a bunch of actions coming up the first week of September around this to try and get Jerry Brown in California and the whole country, really. But really, some of these supposed proponents of green energy and real solutions and ending emissions to understand that fracking absolutely is part of this. And the amount of methane emissions, which is something like 80% or around there, more more of a greenhouse gas than
80 times more.
Right, like than a greenhouse gas than meaning it's a heat trapping gas than CO2 is something that we have to talk about and it's not going to. This is an important goal. I think we could do it sooner. It kind of feels like we're still trying to like squeeze whatever is left out of the state. And then move to renewables when we could be doing that now.
Yeah.
Well,
we have some data for that. Because obviously, look, California is doing okay now. It's reaching some of its earlier goals, like a decade ahead of when it was supposed to. And it currently gets about a third of its energy needs from renewable sources. So that is good. But it also gets 49% from natural gas.
Yep.
Which is just about as horrible as, I mean, I guess it's not as bad as coal in some ways, but in others it's worse. And 9% from nuclear energy, which is its whole other apocalyptic problem. And here's the thing. So let's break down what's actually going on. I say this all the time, but I don't believe that I'm exaggerating that while we have so many other things that we have to talk about, that's the whole point of this show. This is going on in the background every single day. Every day where we have the tweets and then something with DeVos and then, oh, Scott Pruitt did something. Like, okay, we talk about that. We try to fix it where we can. We try to move closer to the election. But a day goes by where we're a day closer to, you know, reaching various dark milestones for our climate.
Yes.
And if there are points of no return, we grow closer to them or farther away from them if we're on the wrong side of them. And that continues every single day. And it takes things like California. And California passing this is obviously, if any state is going to, it's the biggest if it's here because we're the biggest economic output, population, blah, 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 all that stuff. But we also pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord. Like, our government does not have our back on the most important issue for them to have our back on. And for the most important issue for them to work with other countries. We are, you know, we like to consider ourselves, you know, the most important country. But this is not something that even if all of our states had this, that would not be enough. We have to work with other countries. And instead, we are, as you say, we're trying to wring as many dollars out of the coal and natural gas and oil and all of that while we can. Because these old people who are making money off of it right now are going to be long dead before the worst effects of this burning of non-renewable energy is actually seen. And sure, they're screwing over their kids and their grandkids, but they seem to have made their peace with that.
And yet, cable news has no problem sending reporters into like hurricanes and windstorms, just like on rooftops. Mm-hmm. I am here from the biggest hurricane in, well, like 6 months, because there was one off season, and you know, and we're not supposed to draw these connections at all. And I think, to be honest with you, having spoken to a lot of young democratic socialists, young people who are progressives, whether they call themselves democratic socialists or not, unimportant. I think a lot of people understand that actually runaway capitalism and this desire to amass huge amounts of wealth that are, of course, not taxed the way they should be, is killing the planet.
Yep.
And the fact that—
And us,
bye-bye Florida and all your hanging chads. You're gonna go. That's like an old reference, but you know, you know, back to Al Gore and stuff. But you know, I think that also, to your point, we need leadership. And I think, as much as the United States has lost its ability to be a leader in the world, whatever point you put that at, whether for you it was the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, or if it was before that, or if it was whatever, like, this was one of those issues where there was incremental leadership from the previous administration to actually stand with the leaders of the world and say, yes, let's do this. And it came down to the wire. I'd encourage you all, if you haven't seen the second, you know, the sequel to Inconvenient Truth, I thought it was excellent because it showed you sort of that behind the scenes, like, politicking that happens in these agreements, whereas for me from the outside was like, yeah, but it doesn't mean anything. And then you sort of look at the way how it was made, how the sausage was made, and in fact does mean something. Of course, it can go further, but you need to have that leadership. And we've now at this point completely lost any credibility.
Yeah.
Also pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement. Listen, I just can't wait for the big one to hit, and California just cracks off from the San Andreas Fault westward, because like Central Valley, whatever, although there's some important crops out there, but take some crops. We move out with our legal marijuana into the Pacific, bump up against Hawaii,
That would be awesome. Probably not going to happen.
It's all going to work out.
I actually saw a documentary about how that would actually play out, hosted by Dwayne Johnson, and it, the process seems rough. I don't think it's worth it necessarily.
Him pulling it back together?
Yeah, he uses his biceps, Chris Evans style. So you pointed out that they'll send people, you know, to cover hurricane, but as we always say, there's a huge difference between weather and the climate. And they seem to care a lot more about the weather than the climate. In fact, almost every local news show has a weather report. Mm-hmm. How many have climate reports? Maybe we'll have to start that. The forecast will always be the same. We're screwed, but maybe we'll work on it. I do want to mention one last big piece of news that will probably go largely unnoticed is the Trump administration has decided to cancel all U.S. funding for the UN aid program for Palestinian refugees, both in terms of money, but also in terms of recognition, perhaps even more importantly. This is coming after last week, the State Department announced that more than $200 million in aid that had already been appropriated would be redirected elsewhere, perhaps into a slightly bombier form. And so this is a 1-2 shot right into the face of the Palestinian refugees, the movement for peace and all of that. And the way it's described is that the administration plans to voice its disapproval for the way the UN Relief and Works Agency spends the funds and to call for a sharp reduction in the number of Palestinians recognized as refugees at all, dropping it from more than 5 million, including descendants, to fewer than a tenth of that number. Or those still alive from when the agency was created 7 decades ago. And any such reduction would effectively eliminate for most Palestinians the right to return to land contested with Israel. But don't worry, this might sound bad, but we were told that Donald Trump on the issue of Israel and Palestine would probably be good. So this looks bad right now, but I'm sure the news next month will be much more positive for the refugees.
Listen, Jared Kushner will give every one of those former refugees a big ol' hug. Mm-hmm. Don't touch me. And yay, peace. This is pitiful.
Yeah, he will give them a hug. Maybe he'll give them an apartment in one of his horrible places that he's just got
fined for. A settlement that he might be building in the West Bank.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely horrendous. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we've been talking a lot about good results coming out of these primaries, candidates you should be encouraged for. Also, shadiness going on in the primaries. And we've got a case of both of those coming up after the break. We're joined by Pramila Malik, candidate in New York State Senate District 42, to talk about her environmental activism and the stuff that's going on behind the scenes in her primary after this. We have talked about a lot of primaries on this show, and in many cases, on the Dem side, there's been some interference, either from lobbying groups or from state and national Democratic parties. But in this particular case, when it comes to New York State Senate District 42, the interference is perhaps the most unique style that I've seen. And we're thankfully joined right now by Pramila Malik, a candidate in that race, to talk about it. Welcome to the show, Pramila.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm glad to have you here. So I want to jump right into what's going on with your primary, which is coming up in just about 2 weeks, slightly less than two weeks, correct?
September 13th happens to be my birthday.
Happens to be your birthday. Well, hopefully it'll be a good day for multiple reasons for you. So in your district, you're about to have the first ever semi-open primary. What does that mean?
Well, it's because of something our campaign had done. We petitioned to open up a ballot line of the Reform Party. Now, the Reform Party is generally a conservative party, but it's been very vocal on the issue of corruption. And it is a party that's in the midst of a transformation, moving somewhat to the left. But, you know, we found that corruption is really a bipartisan issue that pulls everybody together. And that's kind of what I've been doing. My work has really been focused on fighting corruption for many, many years. So we petitioned to be on that ballot line. We did not get that ballot line through the normal petition process because of something, an arcane New York State law called the Wilson-Pakula Law, in which the party did not allow us to be on the line despite the petition. So we used another process, which is a write-in process. It's called the opportunity to ballot. And we petitioned through that process, which is now going to enable unaffiliated voters for the first time ever to participate in a primary, in a Democratic primary, on the reform line. And they will be able to write my name in on that line and be part of determining who will be the candidate going into the general. So it's a really exciting process to bring in tens of thousands of new voters into the primary process. You know, we've been confronted by numerous games played by the Democratic establishment to thwart our campaign. So we've been looking for creative ways to circumvent them. And we're also looking for ways, again, to bring more voters into the process so that our elections are real elections and not selection processes. And so I'm really excited about it. I'm hoping unaffiliated voters will take this opportunity. It is a first time opportunity, and it may end up being a textbook case as to what a true progressive needs to do in order to circumvent the games of the Democratic establishment.
And that might be the tagline for this entire primary season, actually. I want to focus on one thing that you talked about there. So you talked about fighting corruption in your past. You've been an environmental activist and worked in multiple areas. But I like to make very clear the stakes in these sorts of races. For people living in New York who don't necessarily pay much attention day to day to the state government, when you talk about fighting corruption inside of New York, what forms does that corruption come in?
It comes in many forms. New York State is one of the worst states in the country in terms of corruption. Albany is a cesspool of corruption. I've been involved in fighting a power plant project, and really because of that, by extension, really battling the issue of climate change, which of course has global impacts. And it turns out that this power plant was really approved through a pay-to-play corruption scheme that went to the highest levels of our government in Albany. The governor's closest aide was taking bribery money from the company executive. He has recently been convicted. His name is Joseph Prococo. Again, it's one of the largest corruption scandals in New York State's history. And I was very much involved in filing those initial criminal complaints that led to those indictments and then subsequent conviction. But what it really tells us is that corruption is really at the heart of our climate crises, and corruption is really at the heart of all of our public policy crises of the day, all of our major policy crises of the day. It is the way big money controls our politicians, dictates public policy. They all operate out of the same playbook. And sadly, because I was drafted by circumstance, it is a playbook that I have had to learn how to overcome, how to confront, and how to expose. And so I've become an expert at that, fighting corruption.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned your protest against the power plant, for which you actually spent several nights in jail because of your activism there. We only have another minute, but I do want your reaction to, as someone who's very concerned about the environment, in particular issues of fracking, what you've seen in terms of environmental policy being pushed both by New York and out of DC. They're targeting endangered species. They pull out of the Paris Climate Accords. What do you think as an environmental activist about what's been going on?
So I'll say two things, that our state and national climate policies are really our energy policies. And a lot of the environmental groups have you focus on climate policy, and they don't really focus on energy policy. And that's really where our true climate policy lies, is in our energy policy. As a nation, we are becoming entirely dependent on frack gas, and we see a coordinated effort by both state governments, as well as our national government through the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, through the EPA, to advance that agenda. And I would say that true climate truth and climate solutions lies in between the crack, between climate deception and climate denial. So on the right, you have climate denial. On the left, you have climate deception, giving us false choices, false direction as to what we need to do in order to overcome the climate crisis. Gas has been peddled as a bridge fuel by people on the left, by Democrats. It's not a bridge fuel. It's the worst possible source of energy we can have battle climate change. It's the absolute wrong direction. Methane has much greater of a global warming impact than any other greenhouse gas than CO2. So we're going in the wrong direction, and that's why I'm running, because we are headed down a highway at 100 miles per hour. We're headed right off a cliff, and unless we, the people, grassroots activists, take control over the steering wheel, our children will not have a future. So this is a campaign for people, science, for democracy, but it's really a campaign for life itself.
Wow, that's a strong way to end. Well, Pramila Malik, candidate, New York State Senate District 42, your election is coming up September 13th. Thank you for joining the Damage Report.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to look back on the week. What, if anything, have we learned? We'll be back in a few. Under Donald Trump, you never know what you're going to be exposed to on a weekly basis. Here is what I learned this week. So first, I want to get to what you all learned, because you tweeted it to us about this. First, Angel learned that my stress level goes down when I mute Trump on Twitter for a day. And then the following day, it spikes as I have to catch up on all the horrors I missed during my break. That's true. Have you ever muted Trump or blocked Trump?
No, I don't follow him. Do you follow him?
Here's the thing. Here is why I have steadily lost my sanity. I not only follow Donald Trump, I get notifications when he tweets.
Why?
Isn't that cool? I took it off. I took it off for a long time, and then I brought it back just because.
Here's the pain. That's the most tweets, masochistic thing.
When announcements about changes in government happen on Trump's Twitter, so you kind of have to, unfortunately.
No, you don't. You really don't. I don't follow every like 3 or 4 days. I'll check in and be like. And then lose just all capacity to think and have don't follow him.
Don't follow him. Okay, more that you learned. Arlene Santana, my girlfriend learned some people think $11 an hour is a fair wage. She was having an argument with people about the pay of In-N-Out. And some conservatives were like, they make $11. Why are you complaining about them? $11 might be fine in some areas, maybe. And in other areas, it is just, it's slightly fancier poverty.
Yeah,
so
my goodness.
I don't agree with that.
I am so conflicted on In-N-Out because on the one hand, delicious. On the other hand, lightweight, Bible thumping evangelicals. Weird. Yeah. And also clearly don't think that, that their workers need to be paid a fair wage. I guess, like, you know, the J-man just makes up for the rest of that. Hey-o.
I guess, yeah.
Just pray for it.
You'll
just
earn it on the other side.
Pray for that money.
Oh, charity's great. Angela Nordling learned that Trump can claim that, quote, safe space wanting, weak on borders, trade, Second Amendment rights, snowflake Democrats will suddenly become violent when they win, and that seems rational to his congregation. I like that, his congregation. That is good. Yeah, we cannot forget. One of the many things we can't forget about this week is that he is saying there will be violence if the Democrats win. And it's their fault. They're the one. When I win, I destroy people. To be fair, I come from UConn, where after we win basketball games, we burn cars. So maybe there's something logically to it, but not in terms of elections. No, what he's saying
UConn.
Is wink, wink,
we
nudge,
burn
nudge.
Cars. Sorry. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, what?
My supporters, if they win, tear their heads off. And then blame them for it. That's my interpretation of what he said.
Listen, once again, I've said it many times. I'll say it again here. Welcome to the Americas, America. Okay? Yeah. This is what happens in every other country that maybe the U.S. has or has not invaded or like supported the opposition for. But hey, all around Latin America, that opposition leaders are this sort of like incredibly violent politics are like, yeah, we're going to call for a mass rally if we lose. And I wouldn't be surprised, let's say something on like an anniversary of a women's march, you know, in January, that we might see like a counter protest that is
the
like
a woman's march.
The man's march, you know, because real men don't support women's rights.
It's not one of those million man marches, though. We don't like that. Mm-hmm. It's just there's some men. Okay, so finally, the resistance learned that federal employees are not going to get a raise. And the reason that I point that out is not just because it's obviously major news. And I think it's odd that we think of federal employees as not regular working class Americans, which many of them are, but also that it's we cut taxes massively for wealthy people and then wages go nowhere. Then after that, we screw over the federal employees even more. And then yesterday he announces he's thinking about cutting capital gains taxes again. I mean, there are some politicians that try to hide their economic philosophy from you, and there are others that just scream it into your ear, and all you have to do is hear them and vote accordingly.
That was Trump, right?
Yeah.
I also learned that Andrew Cuomo says, in terms of federal employees, that he doesn't think they necessarily have a right to strike. So he was—
Oh, yes, in the debate.
In
he
the
did
debate
say
against
that, actually.
Yeah. Cynthia Nixon saying that, what are we going to do if we let MTA workers strike or you know—
Hopefully get better working conditions for them.
Exactly.
If teachers strike, what do we do? Raise their wages, maybe. Thank you, Francesca, for joining us.
Thank you,
John.
Always
good to have you here.
Yeah.
Give you a little thing there. great to have you here. Thank you for watching. We'll be back next Tuesday. Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.